exercises and online learning, content syndications, and new media. Stephen has become a leading voice in the areas of learning objects and metadata, web blogs and education, content syndication, digital rights and related issues. And Stephen has a website, www.downs.ca. And now, I'll come to the stop. As access to the internet grows in schools and homes, educators are beginning to take advantage of the wide range of learning opportunities it offers. Steve will present an engaging argument for using the internet as a resource and offer ideas on how to incorporate it into your classroom. Steve, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Thanks. Well, that is quite an echo. There's so many people here at this conference. This room is as full as it could be. My name is Stephen Downs. I work for the National Research Council across the street in Moncton, New Brunswick, for the Institute for Information Technology and specialize in e-learning, online learning applications, technologies, resources, and the like. And I promise to give you a quote-unquote engaging argument that's still way Okay, well, come on up then. Oh, just the echo.
Yeah,
it naturally does it.
Yeah,
we're in a room that's completely constructed by humans, but it naturally does it.
Yeah.
I'm thank you. Okay. Is this better? It's about the same. That's what you saw, the thing I was playing with there just at the start. It's gone. Let's see what where'd it go? Invisible. It is hiding, and it shouldn't be hiding. It should be existing. So, oh, there it is. So this is me recording this talk, and this talk will be posted on the internet because that's what I like to do. I think that's going to be a standard for presentations in the future, and then be the standard for teaching in the future, for it to be recorded in audio and in video, every which way, and posted on the web. I'll have more to say about that as the talk goes through, but I mention it to you now. Oh, geez, where did it go? Sorry. It clears the screen, but then it takes 10 seconds to pop up. So I'm going to give you a quote-unquote engaging argument for integrating the internet into the classroom. I probably shouldn't have promised engaging in the session description, but it's there, and now I have to live up to it. So his teaching today has changed. Teaching today, it used to be, you got in, you got out, there was no recording, the students didn't have MP3 players and photo cameras and all of that, there was no evidence for anything that you did. But it's very different now, there's recording devices everywhere. I'm recording, if you want to record, you can record, please feel free. And if you do record, please feel free to share it, splice it, dice it, whatever you want to do with it. And it's kind of an interesting experience when I record my own talks, because I find that I'm speaking to more than one audience. I'm very aware that no matter what the number of people in the room here, you're very scattered. Actually, there is a respectable number in here. I'll also be speaking to an equal or greater number of people online. So I'm speaking to multiple audiences at the same time. And sometimes, and my loyalties sometimes get divided, and sometimes I'm more loyal to the people that I'm speaking to in the recording. I've tried, but I didn't do it here, because I was told there wouldn't be very many people with computers in the audience, and I'm looking out, is there anyone brought a computer here today? You don't carry the technician, yeah. It's a fascinating thing. We live in the 21st century. Computer technology is everywhere. Here you are at a conference where there are all kinds of sessions and learning and that taking place, and nobody brought a computer to take notes on, which I find very interesting. It's sort of you know, that old style of learning where you sort of sit back and passively receive whatever wisdom the person at the front of the room can impart on you, and at the same time not engaging with it, not interacting with it. What I like to do with sessions like this, and what I do with other conferences, is I make use of the in-room wireless internet. I set up a second screen, and on the second screen I have what's called a back channel. In fact, I did that with the technology contacts yesterday. The three of them had to do, which was great. And I have a screen on the internet that people can look at. They type in their comments, and their comments show up on the screen. So the back channel is actually displayed in front of the room. And that also changes the dynamic, because now there's three things going on. There's the talk to the people in the audience, there's the talk to the people who are listening to the recording, and then there's the talk back and forth with the back channel. And so it creates a different sort of dynamic. Anyhow, the big question that I want to address in this particular talk is the question of why we should integrate technology into our classrooms, why we should be using technology in the delivery of education in schools across the province and indeed across the country. And for those of you who have already, as they say, taken the red pill, think of this as a talk to give you a bunch of ideas for arguments that you can use with other people. And for those of you who aren't yet convinced that technology ought to be used in the classroom, think of this as an extended argument in favor of its use. Now I'm curious. How many of you already agree technology should be used in the classroom? Raise your hand. Yeah. Okay. Just for the record, I was asked to make this talk to convince you. I suppose I should have known that everybody in the audience. But for those of you listening on audio, every hand in the audience went up. So this is definitely a case of preaching to the converted. But nonetheless, I'm still going to go through with it because I've also tried to layer in resources and things that you can use with each of these reasons. So almost in Letterman style. First reason to use technology in the classroom. The school library has only 12 books from this century. To me, this is almost the most compelling reason for using technology in the classroom. And I found it very interesting, even wandering around the concourse today with all the booths and that. Almost all of them were selling physical materials. It was funny seeing how many teachers were pulling out their own wallets to buy books and resources for their classrooms. Books are expensive. They're getting more expensive. K-12 books, college and university textbooks are ridiculously expensive, and there's no sign that that curve is going to change. There's no sign that books are going to stop getting more expensive. If we want to get learning materials, good learning materials, into the hands of students, we have to find ways of being able to access those learning materials online. We can put all of knowledge onto, say, one of these, not a key, a jump drive, for the price of a couple of textbooks. I went out and bought an 8 gigabyte card for less than $100 recently. 8 gigabytes, it's libraries and libraries and libraries of books. There's a trend taking place right now in the world of online learning under the heading of open educational resources. And if you were to do a Google search under the heading of OER, you would find all kinds of stuff. Now, I was wandering around again today and finding stuff that the Canadian government is putting out for students online. Let's see if this works. This is just something that I put up today, just based on what I found around here. So, Agriculture Canada Resources, Environment Canada Resources, Parks Canada, Statistics Canada has a big education outreach project. So the government, Canadian government, and provincial governments, I haven't even tried to sample their stuff yet, putting all kinds of free or nearly free resources online for educators. But the government, it's getting way too loud again. It doesn't stay the same, does it? The government is not the only organization working on this. There's a whole open educational resources community out there. It's backed mostly by agencies such as UNESCO and OECD, and sponsored by organizations such as the Hewlett Fund, things like the MIT Open Courseware, among other things. The Internet Archive, which is something set up by a guy called Brewster Tully to gather all of the content that's ever been put on the Internet, has a section on open educational resources, and there's more. And I think that as time goes by, we're going to see more and more, not simply stuff that you can purchase online, but more and more free and open educational resources to support learning. There's the Open Educational Resources Commons. That's not what I meant to show you. I meant to just flip to the next page. But reason number two. Czechoslovakia is no longer a country. You laugh. I went, again, I went out today, and they have books for sale, and I had one of those books, Stars and Planets. Maybe you saw it. And I opened that book, and I went in, and it's about the third or fourth page into chapter two. Pluto was listed as a planet. And I complained, and they said, well, yeah, it's making a comeback. Events change faster than print-based resources can comprehend, particularly these days. Countries appear, countries disappear. Some countries, island countries, are disappearing under the water. Places where there was ice, there's no ice, etc. You need online resources, online educational resource sites, in order to stay current. And probably the primary example of that is Wikipedia. I'm sure all of you have been to Wikipedia at least once, but there are also a number of other education-specific wiki resources out there, and these are ways for educators to create learning materials that can stay up to date. The way they stay up to date is instead of relying on authors and publishers and publishing companies and that whole process to create learning resources, the educators themselves create these resources. For example, take a look at Wiki Educator, and it's going to take the usual few minutes to pop up here. Wiki Educator is sponsored by the Commonwealth of Learning. The Commonwealth of Learning is an organization, Commonwealth organization, devoted to promoting learning in Commonwealth countries, and especially the Southern and African Commonwealth countries. Is based in British Columbia. And what they've done is they've set up Wiki Educator, which is a place where people can create and edit collectively educational materials. And so you have educational materials in the news, you have educational materials. I don't know if there's a French version of the. I know that there are multi language versions of the. Here we go, yep, Français. So there's the French version as well. Now, the French version isn't going to be exactly the same as the English version, but there's Wiki Educator in French. And if the content you're looking for isn't there, the nice thing is because it's Wiki Educator, you can add the content yourself. And what's really nice about this is when you're adding content for yourself, you're doing it not just for you, not just for your class, but for everybody else who comes along and follows you. The Wikipedia-sponsored version of this is Wikiversity, and this is intended more for the higher level, you know, college and university style learning. It's going to take a few seconds to come up here, so I'll stall by closing other windows. I love wireless, but I hate the wait. So I wanted to come here because I just love this picture. Now this is the sort of thing, when people are paying money for posters of this sort of thing, and yet it's available for free online, and I think actually this is a better one than the ones I've been seeing on posters. The only trick is printing them that big. Oh, yeah. Sorry. That ruins the surprise, doesn't it? I wanted to point out to you as well, if you don't like any of those official wikis, then you can use a site like WikiSpaces in order to create your own wiki. And so if you wanted to create something just for yourself, just for your school, or just for your classroom, set up an account here and then create a WikiSpaces wiki. And then you and the people in your classroom can have your own private wiki-based learning resource that you create yourselves. Yes. Well, I shouldn't be more accurate. It's free to a certain point, and then there's pricing. Comment?
Set up something like that for a class.
I believe you can, yes. The last time I looked, you could. I'm always careful when I say yes or no, because these things change. But the last time I looked, you could. Any other questions? Do feel free to jump in with questions. I'm happy to take questions. It's kind of neat for the people listening on the audio. They get my talk and they get the talk from the next room. All right. Reason number three. Not everybody can tour Mongolia, even though I'm sure everybody wants to tour Mongolia. I know I do. This is a good reason to use the internet metaphor, because it offers you ways to bring places that, you know, normally you would just read about to life in the classroom. It gives you the chance to give your students the actual experience of things around the world. There's the, I wish I could remember the name of the site, but there was a site that came on just last week. Got a big splash in the media. It's the Forbidden City. It was a 3D representation of the Forbidden City in Beijing. Just a fabulous resource. For the purposes of this presentation, I focused on Mongolia for no particular reason, but Mongolia is wonderful. If you use something like Google Maps, so here's Google Maps, I'm going to Mongolia. So, we'll get Mongolia up here in just a second. I should have realized I'm on wireless. It takes a little bit. Yeah. I should have done it in the summer. It looks like it's snowing. Okay, that was funny. That's going to be stubborn. Never mind. Let's go to Mongolia with Flickr instead. Flickr, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a resource site where people post their photographs online. I have my own photographs posted on Flickr. I have 10,000 or so photographs. And what I do with my photographs on Flickr, it's the same thing many other people do with their photographs, is I license my photographs under what is called Creative Commons. And for those of you who are not familiar with Creative Commons, this is a mechanism for licensing your material to make your material freely accessible and usable by other people. So what I do is, when I post a photograph on Flickr, there's a selection box when I'm filling in information about my photo and my account to ask me how I want to license the photo. I say, well, I want to license the photo under Creative Commons, and I select the conditions. There are various conditions you can choose under Creative Commons, and the conditions I've chosen are non-commercial and attribution, which means people can use my work non-commercially, provided they give attribution to me, provided they say, I'm the person who created this particular resource. All kinds of resources on Flickr, there's tens of millions of photographs on Flickr that are available under Creative Commons. I'm not sure whether these are, but these are beautiful photographs anyways. And again, looking at these photographs, this is far more photographs than National Geographic would ever post on Mongolia. I just love these pictures. And it's just, all I did is I went to Flickr and typed in Mongolia. And if you go into Flickr, you can type in pretty much anything and you'll get a world of fascinating resources. What else can we get about Mongolia? Well, of course, we can get information about Mongolia on Wikipedia, and this will be right up to date, unlike your encyclopedia, which probably also includes Tenu Tawu and other non-existent countries. And if you want something more dynamic, probably not on CBC, you can go to YouTube and get here's what's happening in Mongolia today. So, again, you get the feeling of being right there. So I did this research, and in a sense, it sort of shows in about 30 seconds. And that's one of the brilliant things about this. Compare how much time it would take you to get encyclopedia information, current photographs, video, and other information, and a non-existent map for some reason, any other way. Reason number four. Nobody here speaks Kazakh. I looked it up. Kazakh is a language, and this apparently is a sample of that, but I can't verify that. But the point is, if you're trying to learn languages, if you're trying to learn languages the way I tried to learn, say, French, when I grew up, I was trying to learn French, I was living in an English community. Everybody in my community that spoke French with a heavy English accent. So I learned how to speak French with a heavy English accent. I learned how to speak French with a lot of English words in the French, with a lot of English grammar in French. In other words, I didn't learn French very well. But if you have contact with and conversations with people who actually speak the language you're trying to learn, that makes it much more easy to learn, and you learn it better. There's all kinds of resources now on the internet, some commercial, some for free, to support language learning. One site, they don't have French yet, but they have Spanish Pod. Spanish Pod's pretty neat because you can, it's a social network, so you sign up for Spanish Pod, you get a collection of friends, they send you audio feeds every once in a while, you can join conversations, there are lessons, as you can see. Now, a lot of Spanish Pod is commercial, which means you have to pay for it, which means I can't access it because I don't like paying for these things. But there are some things like that for free. There are other language learning resources that are online that are free. There's one group of people, I don't have it on the slide, I really should have put it on the slide, called the Webheads. And what the Webheads are is an international group. Maybe I'll pop in, I should be able to find it fairly easily. For those of you who use, Internet Explorer, this is Firefox. You should take the Internet Explorer on your machine. I guess you can't erase it or delete it or anything like that, but ignore it and install Firefox. It's an open source browser which is much better and much safer and much faster than Internet Explorer. So I just had to put that advertisement in. So, Webheads. And what the Webheads are. This is a beautiful computer, but it always drops the first letter. It's a community practice, as it says. It's a collection of... It's a collection of people involved in the teaching of English as a second language around the world. And they have a variety of activities. They're in a bunch of different places. This is just one of the places. And basically, they support each other, and they provide English teaching online with each other. I don't know how else to describe it. Definitely, if you're involved in language learning of any sort, I would definitely recommend that you look at Webheads in action. Reason number five. Nobody else on the football team is into macrame. And it took a little bit longer to find macrame footballs on the internet, but I did succeed. Those are sort of macrame footballs. Actually, they're also owls, but they have football-shaped owl thing. This is one of the early eye-opening experiences that I had when I was learning about all of this stuff. A woman called Claire Brooks from Western Australia came online, and she spoke to us about the use of online learning in farms and sheep stations in Western Australia. And one of the things that struck her, she noted, was that from place to place, here and there, intermittently were people who were interested in knitting. And It would take, took me a little while, but I was helped at a few stations. Maybe, I guess there is a connection. But the thing is, they were the only people in their community that were interested in knitting, and they, so they were all alone and very isolated. But when they got internet access, they were able to connect with each other. They were able to interact, to trade ideas, to trade whatever it is that knitters trade. I have no idea what knitters trade, but they traded it. And they were able to form this community of knitters, and they didn't feel so all alone, and they didn't feel so isolated anymore. That's this, that happens, that's the same thing that happens in communities in Canada, and probably in many of your own communities. I think of the World Politics course that we offered in Manitoba. This was in the late 1990s. It was taught over the Brandon Adult Learning Center. And basically, the reason why we did that was that the schools in Manitoba, 100 here, 200 there, 250 there, they're small schools. They couldn't have a world politics course at the grade 11 and grade 12 level. There were only one or two students interested in the subject. But we put it online. We had a teacher who taught it online. And so we had one student here, two students there, all connected by internet, all interacting on a regular basis online. And so we were able to serve this niche interest, and we were able to offer a type of course that normally would not be offered in a smaller community. And this is really useful for non-educational purposes as well. In Minnedosa, which is a small town of, I don't know, 500,000 people, about an hour north of Brandon, there's one Goth. If you think about it, one Goth. It'd be horrible to be the only Goth in Minnedosa and to not have any other Goths to talk to. But this person now is able to connect to other Goths online and do whatever it is that Goths do. And that's a true story. What's really significant about the internet is you can find your own niche groups online. I prefer Yahoo groups. Yahoo groups have been around forever. I still use them. They seem almost old and quaint now, but here are all the different Yahoo groups that I belong to. Oh, well, there's more. And they're very niche groups. There's Yahoo groups on everything. Pick a topic. There's Yahoo groups. Search for other groups. Let's search for other groups. Bees. Is there a Yahoo group on bees? Yes, there is. There are many. Apis newsletter, beekeeping, whatever. Anyhow, I can go on with that forever. There was an article by a woman named Erin Brewer, and she did a study of Yahoo groups on bees. It wasn't really a random selection. And she talked about how the people in these bee Yahoo groups negotiate learning among themselves, because there are some very experienced beekeepers in the group, and there are novice beekeepers. And I'm not going to make jokes about being stunned, that would be too bad. But they want to learn the trade and all of that. And so they ask questions, and then this process of negotiation happens, because the experienced beekeepers don't just answer the question. The novice beekeeper says, well, how do you do such and such? And the experienced beekeeper says, well, why do you want to know this? The novice beekeeper says, well, I'm trying to do such and such. And the experienced beekeeper says, well, then you don't want to do that, you want to do this. And so this negotiation happens back and forth. And that's how the learning happens in this group. It's not simply the presentation of some kind of received knowledge, but it's this interaction, communication, trying to target in on some kind of learning need that the novice didn't even know that they had. Reason number six, anyone, absolutely anyone, can be Napoleon. On the internet and using technology generally, you can approach learning through a variety of simulations and games. And the value of simulations and games, in my mind, not simply the fact that students will play them for 24 hours at a time without stopping, but it allows people to see things from different perspectives, to put on different hats, take on different roles, different identities. And it puts you into the context, different contexts of different things. simulations, especially obviously, airlines have been using simulations forever for training. The military uses simulations extensively at the Canadian Forces Base in Gagetown, for example, to have a simulated helicopter. You get into the helicopter, you fly the helicopter around, or if you're me, you get into the helicopter and you crash it immediately. There are things like Second Life. I'm sure many of you have heard of Second Life. There's a variety of Second Life initiatives, and there's a project out there called Second Life in Education, or SLED, that you can access to get information about the use of virtual worlds of learning and civilization in the classroom resources. There's a few links here. These slides, by the way, will be available on my website after the talk, so there's no need to copy the links down. You'll be able to access the slides themselves. But Second Life is not the only 3D world going. And indeed, I think in the long run, it won't even be the main 3D world because it's a commercial one, and pretty much anything and everything goes in Second Life. And most people don't want to conduct educational activities in the same place where there's all kinds of gambling and stuff happening. You can set up things like OpenSim or OpenCroquet. I'm really sorry about the pronunciation of that, but you can imagine where that was developed. That's what they call it. And these are basically open source versions of 3D World. Dave Cornhead, who works at the University of Prince Edward Island just down the road, was very well known for something called EdTech Talks and a variety of other projects, uses OpenSim for a virtual history project that he's been working on. Civilization 3, and these days now Civilization 4, Civilization is a game, I don't want to say video game because that's not quite, it's a computer game, it's more accurate. That's where I spend way too much of my own time, I must confess. And what's neat about using a game like Civilization in the classroom is that the way the game is designed is you don't have to play it the way it comes out of the box. What they do is they give you the game, well, you buy the game, and then you can modify, or as they say, mod the game. And so, and online, there are various, they call mod kits. And you download the mod kit, and it's customized graphics and customized characters, and the game operates according to various rules. You can change the rules. This would specify the victory conditions or how fast players were all punished, and things like that. So, with a mod kit, with Civilization, you can actually create very precisely modeled activities around specific events. So you can build, for example, Civilization Prince Edward Island Edition, and the game would be Prince Edward Island. You can have the Easterners and the Westerners fighting each other or whatever. Well, I shouldn't say that. You probably don't want to do that. But you can have things like set conditions so that you have what they call cultural victory. Space race victory in Civilization, so you can win by doing things other than conquering the entire world, or in this case, the entire island. Civ 3 in the Classroom is a website with a bunch of resources. Apollyton is one of my favorite sites, and it's devoted to everything Civilization. Sure. Go back and click on which. Sure. There's a polyfill. So here's Civilization 4. And it's set up, there's articles that come out, different patches for Civilization. And Civilization 4 itself has a number of companion sets. On packs. That's the thing these days. When you buy a game from the store, you get the game all, then you go online and download all the bug fixes. Well, you can access them from home. Well, yeah, okay. This comes up every time, and I'll give the standard answer. They should not be blocked. And, you know, I can't unblock them from here. It doesn't change the fact that they should be unblocked. And from my perspective, all of you need to look at not simply the fact that they're blocked, but you should be asking, and you probably know this, you don't need me to tell you this, you should be asking who is doing the blocking and on what grounds they are doing the blocking. Because in many cases, the grounds on which some of these things are being blocked are ridiculous. That somebody heard a scare story somewhere and so they blocked them. Or they bought the wrong kind of, the wrong products to block sites. And so you're getting this long list of sites that somebody in, I don't know, East Texas thinks should be blocked. Whatever. So, but other than that, you know, I mean, this blocking thing is a temporary thing. It's not going to last. And I don't think that the best way to learn about these sites is to block them. I have a section later on where I talk about social networking sites. And that's usually when the question comes. I didn't expect it to come up with civilization. I mean, this is so innocuous. But with social networks, right? I'm going to say in a minute, you want to teach your students to use Facebook responsibly. You can't do that if Facebook is blocked. Who is they in this case?
Department of Ed.
Who's making the decision? It's a tech guy. On what ground? Okay. And you guys tolerate that. In a democracy. Yeah? Why not? You know what I would do? Because I'm an information gorilla from way back. I would find a house near the school. I'd get cable internet, I'd run coax into the school. And if it was too far, I'd set up a little microwave link, a direct microwave link from the house to the school. I mean, this is Canada in the 21st century, and some computer science guy is saying, or computer systems guy is saying, you can't watch Facebook or YouTube. It's ridiculous. So somebody else had their hand up first and then you. Yes.
Some of these sites are blocked because teachers request them to be blocked. Like MSN.
Right.
Or Facebook. Because if you take 30 students in the computer lab and you ask them to go online and do some research, and you assume that they're just going to do research, then you're the only fool in the room.
You had a comment as well? Yep. Oh, yeah. There, well, there's all kinds of ways of accessing YouTube, even though it's blocked, and your students know them. And, you know, I mean, okay, it's not the topic of this talk, but on the one hand, you've got the stuff that you're trying to do, like teach them history. the other hand, there's the stuff that they want to do, like use MSN. And the traditional approach is just block MSN, or blot out the windows to stop them from looking outside, too, because that might distract them. On the other hand, and the approach that I would favor is an approach that engages students more and uses their inclination to use things like MSN. Now, I understand very clearly the situation in which you're working, where, as you just said, there isn't time to do all of this stuff. But from my perspective, it seems to me that rather than simply saying, oh, well, we're being told we have to do such and such, and therefore we have to block things and simply do this and this and this and this, that it's necessary to view wider access and wider use of the internet on a long-term basis and to be working toward that everywhere at every step. I have, and let me take this from a different perspective, because I don't think of, despite this presentation, it's a nice presentation and all, but I don't think of the internet as something that you can use in order to teach other people things. I think that's a misuse of the internet. I think if you're telling people, go use the internet to look up the Battle of Waterloo or whatever, that's a misuse of the internet. I view the internet as a tool that you can use in order to improve your own learning and your own research, your own professional development. I have a presentation using the internet to support your own learning and development. And that, I think, is the way to approach the use of internet resources, where it's something that the students use because they want to improve their own learning rather than because they're doing something you told them to do. Now, we have this model of learning in the schools using the internet where we still tell people what to do, is use the internet, go to this, use the internet, go to that. And it's no better than go to the library and do this, go to the library and do that. And it's not what you would do to learn. It's not how you would learn. You wouldn't expect to be told to sit down and learn this, told to sit down and learn that. I would certainly hope not, anyways. In your own cases, your learning comes as a byproduct to support whatever it is you actually want to do with your lives. Part of that is to work as teachers or professionals in teaching, and part of that is to support your hobbies like beekeeping or deep sea fishing or whatever it may happen to be. And your access to the internet isn't categorized as productive and non-productive. Your access to the internet is categorized as supporting the things I want to do with my life, whether that happens to be chatting with my friends or whether that happens to be looking up deep sea fishing on Google or watching videos of protesters in Mongolia, whatever that happens to be. You know, and it's funny, we're in a world now where, and it's on the slide later on, collaboration is the new math. We want people to learn how to be able to work together and collaborate, and something like MSN messaging is exactly the tool to do that, and they only knew how to use it properly. And that's the same thing that we're trying to stop. Sorry, diatribe ended. I may not have convinced you, but I hope that I'm pointing or sketching roughly an alternative view on some of this. Any other comments, responses, things to throw? Speaking of motivating, speaking in front of an audience is motivating. Not just for you, but also for your students. And again, President Bach is going to say, but all of these sites are blocked. Yeah. But for those students who have the luxury of being able to access blogging sites such as Blogger or LiveJournal or WordPress or any of the others, they can do things like do writing online in such a way that people are able to read it. And there's all kinds of examples there. The big long link there is to a paper that I wrote on education and blogging for Educause Review a few years ago. Clarence Fisher, who is a teacher who works in northern Manitoba, I think it's Leaf Rapids, Manitoba, talks about using blogging and other tools with his students. And what it does is Leaf Rapids is like 200, 500 people in the middle of nowhere in Manitoba. The only time you ever hear about Leaf Rapids is when there's a forest fire because they have to evacuate the entire town. That happens every 2 or 3 years. But otherwise, they have no contact with the outside world, which is ridiculous. It's crazy. But when they engage in blogging, they do. Or there's the story of the class at École Saint-Joseph in Quebec City. And I talked to the principal there. They have been grade 5 students and their grade 6 students blogging. And they have basically a three-way blogging system set up. One blog where the student writes only for parents and teacher. Another blog where the student writes for parent, teacher, and the other people in the school. And then a third where the student writes for everyone, for the whole world. And he was telling me the students went downtown to watch the circus. Circus came through, students went to watch the circus. Great old time, came back, and of course, what do? You blog about it. So the student blogged about the circus that he had just seen. About a week goes by, someone from the circus reads the review and writes back. And that's an eye-opening movement, an eye-opening moment for the student, because all of a sudden, the student realizes the work that's going on this blog can be read by everybody, including the people he's writing about. And so it becomes, it's not simply a way to connect, but all of a sudden, the student is a little more precise with his spelling, a little more precise with his grammar, his punctuation, and a little more precise with the sort of things that he says, because doing things for an audience is more motivating than doing things for, well, no audience. Number 8, and this harkens to, I guess, some of the surprise, he's not here. Collaboration on the test is no longer cheating. And this harkens to the point that I was making earlier. Collaboration and teamwork skills are, as I say, the new math. I wanted to say the new black. It didn't really work in an educational context, but a new math. And these can be practiced in a classroom, sure. And of course, you have your classes do group work and things like that. But the thing with doing group work in your own class, in your own school, is these are people that students have always known. But if they're doing collaborative or teamwork or group work activities with people on the internet, now they're creating the conditions for this collaboration from scratch. They're actually learning how to create teams and how to create collaborations with people where they don't know the people. And that's something that is more like what we're going to do in real life. And it's much better to negotiate collaboration with people you don't know where you can't just simply assume they have the same objectives, same background, same way of speaking as you do. All kinds of ways to collaborate online. Is Skype blocked too? I shouldn't get on that. Okay, no, let me ask a different one. How many of you have heard of Skype? Okay, how many of you use Skype? Well, that's good. First thing, and with this audience, I probably should have predicted that. Again, it's exactly the wrong audience for this talk, which kind of figures I should have taken the people who are at this conference who are not you would have probably been the appropriate audience for this talk. Another place that didn't come out sounding nearly as good as I meant it. I'm sorry. Another type of collaboration is Google Documents. I use Google Documents quite a bit myself. Just pop into it here. So it takes a couple of seconds again. And I use it to write papers with people. For example, this is a paper I'm writing with Daniel Lemire. Daniel Lemire is a professor who works at University of Quebec at Montreal. And so he and I and Seth Paquette are working on a paper. And all we do to work on this paper is we put the paper in Google Documents. We can all work on the paper at once. And I mean quite literally at once. He, Sam, and I can be on this document, typing on this document at the same time. And document updates as we're working on it. So we can quite literally collaborate in this space. I think Google Docs is a fantastic way of collaborating with people who are at a distance from you. Of course, there's all kinds of the Google applications. Other tools, I'm not sure I'd call them collaborations engines so much as conferencing engines, but things like Illuminate or Adobe Connect or things like that can also be used to support collaboration, or even interactive television if you're still using that. Reason number 9, instant messaging is cheaper than SMS. I'm thinking about retiring reason number 9 because now you're getting these all-YouTube SMS packages on your cell phones now. But it's an extension of the same point. People are attached to their communicators, they're attached to their cell phones. To find out them using MSN, a lot of them using MSN, but just use their cell phones. Or just use their cell phones. Pardon? They're blocked too. You're able to block them? Well, they're banned in the school. Of course, they're banned in the school. We live in a modern, industrialized, communicating society that functions on things like phones, and they're blocked in our schools. I mean, can someone explain to me this? I don't get it, personally. I mean, what world are you preparing them for? Do you all agree that all these things should be blocked? How many of you agree that they should be blocked? Okay. All right, let's go with cell phones. How many of you agree cell phones should be banned? All right. How many don't? All right, one of them banned. Give me the argument. I want to understand this. I guess my question would be, how are you going to know that how do you teach them not to take that inappropriate picture if they have no opportunity to do so? It's not your job. So, school, face-to-face only, no cell phone. And you don't see the need for them to be using the cell phone in the school, not even to talk to each other. Well, yes, especially not to talk to each other. So that's not a skill they're going to need after school, then. I love the irony there. Technician, agreed. Go ahead. No, I don't. My own thinking on this is that what's being done in the school should be interesting and engaging enough, and more aligned with the student's own interests and inclinations, so that you don't run into this sort of competition between what you're trying to make the student do and what they want to do. Now, I understand that a lot of this is outside of your hands. What I don't understand is that, oh, there's nothing I can do about it attitude. It's like some computer science services guy says you can't do anything, and 1,500 teachers say, oh, we're stuck now. I don't get that. You know, and if I were your students, I would be the sort of student who said, you know, and I'm sure there's, you know, you ban cell phones in the class, and there's the part of the class that says, oh, well, I guess they're banned, there's nothing we can do. And I would be the part of the class that's thinking, okay, he may think he can ban cell phones, but let's see what we can do about that, because I'm not going to accept it. And, you know, it seems to me that the lesson that's being taught when you ban cell phones and get people to accept it is quiet obedience to authority. And that is the last lesson I would want to teach in any one of my classrooms. But the other side of it too, now, like, I would expect maybe that they should have their cell phones on vibrate,
yeah.
Right? You know, rather than ringing out loud. But, you know, this is a connected world. If the student's in the class and there's an emergency at home, parents expect to be able to contact the student. You can do it through the office. Well, sure they can do it through the office, but it's better to just call the student directly. Why would you need to do it through the office? Is that going to be less disruptive to the class?
No.
Do it through the office. You can do lots of things through the office. You can run all internet through the office, too, as it was happening. It's not a solution. Which comment? Or did he leave? He's done. So when he said he was ready to leave, he was actually in the act of leaving. I don't know. Something, I think, to do it through the office. Anyhow. I'm sorry, it just puzzles me on two levels. It puzzles me the reason why it's done. But the more important level where it puzzles me is that so many people simply acquiesce to that and think, yeah, that's okay. When if it was done to them in their own lives, they would be up in arms, or maybe they wouldn't be up in arms. Maybe we're setting ourselves up for a society where it's okay if the government just shuts down our communication because that's what we learned in school. Reason number 10. How am I doing with time? Okay, you don't accept that?
No, I don't.
That's fine.
I'm not asking my students to do something that I don't do. When I go and do work, whether it's at school or anywhere else,
mm-hmm.
I go there and for a period of time, I have a task to perform.
Mm-hmm.
I do that, and I don't expect to be interrupted or to be going off and doing my own thing while I'm performing. When I go into class, my phone is put away.
there's other ways for people to contact me. And unless it's an emergency, I don't feel that I should be interrupting myself and all the other people around me. So when I tell my students, when you come into this room, you have a task to perform, we're going to be doing work. Whether it's discussion, whether it's a project with the group, whether we're out in a field doing water samples. During that time, you don't need to be texting on your cell phone. Out of respect for myself and other students, that doesn't belong in this room. Neither does your MP3 player. You don't need to be listening to music while you're having a conversation with other people. It's distracting. And you're not giving them your full attention. It's disrespectful. So when you say, I'm expecting my students to do something that I would not allow to be imposed on me, that's not true. When I have a task, I'm giving it my full attention. And it's not, so when I say I don't want the cell phone, the MP3 or anything else, I think that maybe you've gotten a misimpression of what my expectations are and my reasons behind it.
I think there's a big difference between you choosing that way of working for yourself and you imposing that way of working on yourself.
I'm not talking about a way of working.
Sure.
I'm not talking about writing a paper while you're listening to music or doing something texting. I'm talking about having something that you're performing and doing things that are going to interfere with that and with other people.
So the people in this room who have their cell phones with them here now and they're not turned off, they all disrespect me? Is that the attitude I should be taking? Would that be a reasonable attitude to
take? If my cell phone goes off, so you're telling me you're
so someone's just went off. Should I be insulted now? And should I swarm at that person? Would that be a reasonable attitude?
If I take it out, it's different if it rings, the person just puts it away, forgot to turn it off, whatever. If I take it out and I start making a phone call or I'm texting, obviously I'm not giving you my attention. And that's right.
I know there are other places I did a talk, and I don't have a problem. They actually provide tables and power hookups so that people can be on their computers and doing whatever while I'm doing the talk. I don't have a problem with that because I don't think it's necessary for people to be spending all and only their time looking at me. You know, if you look at it from simple rate of data transfer, right? The data coming from me to you, that, let's even assuming it's all good data, and some people are voting with the feet saying it's not, but even assuming it's all good data, it's coming at a rate of like 300 baud, right? You know, there's almost no data coming from me to you. And so that leaves lots of time for you to be doing other things.
I guess we're just going to have a disagreement.
We're just going to have a disagreement. But the difference between me and you is I'm not imposing my way of doing things on you. But you think it's okay to impose your way of doing things on your students.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I don't think we're going to come to an agreement
today. No.
And don't get me wrong, I understand to a certain extent where you're coming from. I'm not sure that you comprehend or are accepting. Or
I think I comprehend. I don't think I'm accepting. I didn't put up with being told what to do when I was in school, and I don't put up with being told what to do when I'm out of school. So far as what I'm hearing here, it continues to be that way. And that's...
I think there's a difference between imposing will and making expect. I mean, no one's imposing on me when I go to work certain things I do. I do them because that's part of the job.
When
the students come into the class, they have a job to do as well, and there's an expectation. Anyway, I don't want to keep going on this because, like I said, I don't think we're going to come to an agreement.
No, we're probably not going to come to an agreement, but I find this useful. At least it's worthwhile for me to hear his perspective, even though I don't agree with it. What should I do? Let me continue. Anyhow, you Google them, they Google you. I'm curious, how many of you Google your students? Nobody? How many of you know what I mean when I say Google your students? Y'all, but none of you do it. Why not? Why? Well, presumably you'd like to know what they're interested in. Ask them, and they lie. I would. Anyhow, they're Googling you. The thing with the use of the, and again, if it's blocked, none of this applies to parents, right? You teach them how to write on paper and have to, whatever, non-computer jobs. But if you have access to Google in your classroom, you can demonstrate and show them how to use Google and other things, because Google is not the only service online, to do things like research. People say, oh, well, you shouldn't be using Wikipedia to do research. I don't want to see Wikipedia in a research paper. I'm sure you've all heard that before, and that's quite right. And you wouldn't want to put an Encyclopedia Britannica article as your source in a paper either. But what do you do then? Well, if you're a good researcher and you know nothing about the subject, you start with resources like Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica or World Book or any of these things, and you follow from them to more primary sources. Now, how do you know how to do this? Well, the way you know how to do this is if you see people doing it in a classroom. The way you know how to do it is if you see people demonstrating that kind of research. You know, the most powerful thing that you said, of the things that you said, that I take home with me is, this is the way I do my job. Right? This is the way I treat my phone. This is the way I approach my work. And that's the most powerful part of the learning. The actual content, I think, of what you say in moments like that is very minimal. It's the example that you're setting, I think, that's more important than anything else. And I think showing people by example how to handle a cell phone, how to handle Google research, how to handle Wikipedia when you're trying to find out information about things, how to verify things. You know, you're talking in class, something comes up, you look it up on Wikipedia, you read a sentence on Wikipedia, and then the next thing you should be saying is this true? And then verifying it. And showing students how to understand, not simply how to read stuff from Wikipedia, but how to read stuff and read other stuff and make a decision for themselves about whether or not they think it's true. Being able to access these online resources in a classroom is crucial to being able to learn the skill of how to interact with these resources. We can't simply take text as known to be true anymore. Just because it's printed doesn't mean it's true, and we need to develop the skills in order to be able to assess that. Reason number 11, you should learn something about Facebook. And seriously, your students spent a lot of time in there, maybe or maybe not in class. It depends on whether they've gotten their SSH tunnels up and running. But at the very least, teachers and students should know something about how social networks operate, what appropriate behavior is in a social network, see examples of good behavior and bad behavior in a social network, and deliberately pick a relatively tame picture. And of course, there's lots of less tame pictures I could have picked from Facebook to use as an example here. But you know, when deep people post things in Facebook, they don't think about it so much, but when they see what other people have done in Facebook and they're sitting in class and laughing at that idiot who's lying on the floor or whatever, then they have second thoughts about posting pictures like that of themselves up on Facebook. Students don't always use social networks appropriately, but it's not simply a matter of spelling out a set of rules. You should do this, you should do this, you should do this, because interaction in these networks is very complex. And because it's complex, the best way to learn about it, again, is to see people interacting and to interact with them. You know, if I was going to make a rule about Facebook use in my class, I'd say something like, okay, I expect all of you to friend me in Facebook so I can see what you're up to. Of course, they might not like that either. Anyhow, there's a list of some social networks and websites. The bottom two there, Ning and ELGG, are sites where you can build your own social networks. And again, if you want to build them for class activities or things like that. Reason number 12, nobody uses trigonometry on the bus. Don't normally see people doing trig for fun on the bus. You don't normally see people doing trig for fun anywhere. And the question is always, why should we use trigonometry? And, you know, in your normal offline life, there really is no reason to use trigonometry until you get into engineering school or physics class or whatever. But on the internet, you can get involved in projects that lead you into doing projects like this. My own experience with trigonometry, I did not learn trigonometry in grade 12. I did not learn trigonometry at Algonquin College. I did not learn trigonometry at the University of Calgary when I studied in there for the third time. I learned trigonometry when I was sitting there on my computer during a Christmas break trying to create the perfect Star Trek game. And part of the perfect Star Trek game is you have a flat view screen, and you have a Klingon vessel, and you want to rotate the Klingon vessel on your screen, on your view screen. And in order to rotate your vessel on your view screen, you need to know trigonometry to get all your line lengths right. So that's when I learned trigonometry. And I think activities online that draw students in, activities such as things like game building or programming, web programming, whatever, are the sorts of things that draw students into wanting to do some of the stuff that they would otherwise be asking, why should we be doing such and such? And learning to code can save the world. Okay, well, maybe not. But learning to code, learning to create projects online leads students in general to have an appreciation for skills that they might not otherwise have. The student creating, even if something as simple as a blog, or something more interesting or more complicated, like a database application, programming online puts them in an environment where they're creating a product for users, they're creating a product that interacts with other services across the web. And it leads to an appreciation of the need not only for computer science and not only for mathematics, but for things like English in order to put content on their website or on their services, for art and design so that their sites aren't ugly and horrible. Reason number 14 to use the internet in the classroom, and this is for the teachers. Teachers need somebody to talk to. Access to the internet is something that gives you a place to be able to communicate on a regular basis with other teachers. Teaching can be, at least my own experience was, a very lonely job where you spend most of your time in your class with your students and your interactions with other teachers are minimal at best. But being able to do work with the internet in your classroom means that you can start doing things like collaboration with other teachers either across the hall, across the province, or around the world. It's a way to involve yourself and to engage yourself with other people who are teaching the same subject at the same level in various places. There are various projects involved in this around the world, things like the Flat Classroom Project, or a project that I'm involved with called Connectivism and Connected Knowledge, which is a course that I'm offering with George Siemens. George works at the University of Manitoba, and of course I work in Moncton here in New Brunswick. So normally we don't get a whole lot of time to interact with each other, but because we're co-teaching this course, it gives us an opportunity to talk in some detail about these issues that are interesting to us and the actual mechanics of offering the class, as well as talking about the subject matter itself. It gets the students out of the class. This harkens back to some of the comments that have come up earlier. I personally don't think putting the students in a classroom and talking at them or having them do things for 6 hours a day or whatever is the best way to design an educational system. I think that in an environment where we have now the possibility of ubiquitous internet access, where you can be online all the time, connected all the time, able to access learning resources no matter where you are, that learning can and should take place elsewhere. Students should be learning about forestry in a forest. They should be learning about law in a courtroom. They should be learning about cooking in a kitchen. There are many places where students can be learning other than in a classroom, and it seems in a certain way to me not the best way to go about it, to separate them from all of society and expect them to be able to pick up everything that they need to know about how to function in an increasingly complex society in an environment where they're isolated from that society. That doesn't mean that you just throw them into the community and hope that they don't break things. But it does mean that our instruction can begin more and more to be integrated with the activities that take place in the community. And it means that more and more people in the community will need to assume a larger role, not as teachers properly so-called, but as people who, while they're doing their function of whatever it is that they do, also have a role of modeling and demonstrating the activity that they're undertaking. So that people who are not skilled in that can observe, can watch, can practice the same thing for themselves, and that way learn from the actual practice of people doing things in the real environment. It has always been too difficult to do this in the past. It would have been impossible. There would have been no way to offer students support, guidance, counseling, or even protection from the sorts of things that can happen out there in the community prior to communication technology. But if they're always connected, if they're always just, an instant message away, I won't take that as an editorial comment, then this kind of community learning becomes possible. Now, it's funny, and this discussion just puts this into the highlight. The school, it seems sometimes, is the only place that doesn't have internet. And I know that's not strictly true, but, with most of the internet blocked, in a certain way it is true. But, in Moncton, we have wireless internet on our city buses. And if you have an iPod Touch, which, pretty much any student can get these days by hook or by crook, then they have access to this on city buses downtown, with Freddy's on downtown, and everywhere else. Everything we do is infused by the internet, except it seems at school. And I think that there is a responsibility there to ensure that students are prepared for this world. And the way to prepare students for this world, where the internet is everywhere, is not to hide them from it. And we can come up with reasons till we're blue in the face about why it's a good thing to hide them from the internet. But the fact is, if you're hiding them from the internet, if you're blocking them from this access, then they're not learning how to use it responsibly. They're learning, in fact, how to use it irresponsibly, because that's the only way they're allowed to use it. So this was a talk about why to put the internet in the classroom, but it was also very briefly talked about how to do it. Use the internet in the classroom to access current materials, current events, to broaden students' experiences, to support language training as appropriate, and to use the internet to engage students' niche interests. Use the internet to find or plan simulations or immersions. Have students present stuff online. Have students work collaboratively, build collaborative exercises for students to to work on online. Build communication into learning. Instead of fighting against, and I know they're not here anymore, instead of fighting against MSN Messenger, use MSN Messenger as part of the way you design your learning. Use the internet to find out about students, not to spy on them, but to learn about them, their people. Get to understand what kind of projection, what kind of identity they project on the internet. Spend time in social networks. Integrate the class lesson into creative projects. Support deep learning, difficult programming projects, not all of them necessarily, difficult research projects to do, and see how what they see on the internet stimulates them and engages them in learning that is far deeper than something that you can typically provide in the classroom. Build, as a professional, your own personal learning network. Make your own connections. Build your own resource bases, establish your own identity and your own presence online. And then finally, integrate, use the internet to integrate your students, and for that matter, yourselves, into the community. Some other papers that I've written, and those are all available on my website. I hope I haven't gone too far over time. I think I'm a little over time. But I thank you, those of you who remained, for your patience. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.